So as you can see, Michael's talk is on tensorial concomitance and the non-existence of gravitational stress energy tensor, or more briefly, there is no gravitational stress energy tensor. I'll just say a few words quickly about the background of the talk. The issue of gravitational energy arose almost, well, not even immediately, when I first formulated the theory. He was actually struggling with the issue during the talk from 1912, 1913 on. And the very first paper he wrote after the initial publication of the theory in late 1915 was a paper about the status of gravitational energy. So this is an issue that has a very long and distinguished and important historical pedigree. For instance, it was Hilbert's puzzlement over the issue that directly led him to ask Emmy Noether to begin the investigations that resulted in her famous theorems relating symmetries and conserved quantities. And over the past, 80 years or so, 90 years or so, let's see, let me do the arithmetic, yes, 90 years, you basically cannot throw a rock at the history of physics, history of general relativity, and not hit a physicist who has at one time or other expressed an opinion about gravitational energy. And it's actually quite surprising, almost without exception, the arguments and statements they make about it are uniformly terrible. And these are from some of the greatest physicists of the 20th century. But somehow when it comes to gravitational energy, they seem to lose it. The great exceptions to this are, in my mind, are Cowley and Eddington, who both had very, very useful and interesting things to say about it, but almost no one ever paid attention to them for some reason on this issue. So, the background is that, as I say, it's folklore in the field that there is no way to define a localized invariant quantity that whose proper interpretation, appropriate interpretation, would be the representation of a stress energetic or even just an energetic measure of gravitational field intensity. Now, as I say, that's folklore in the field. I actually know of no rigorous argument to that effect over the past 90 years. Just a lot of bad handwaving, and almost all of it involving the principle of equivalence. So the talk is, but the purpose of the talk is actually to formulate and prove a rigorous result I claim whose natural interpretation is that there is no such thing. So this is a result that shouldn't be surprising to anyone who knows the history. I'm agreeing with the folklore and the mythology of the field. I'm just trying to actually state rigorously and prove what folklore has held, and also hoping somewhat to clarify why it is that this result holds. So the talk will be as follows. I'll begin by just very quickly reviewing the status of energetic quantities in general relativity, such as they are, what general relativity makes available for the representation of stress energy, and what properties that representation has
in order to be able to formulate rigorous, precise conditions on what a gravitational stress energy should have if there were such a thing. I'll then review the standard argument that, like I say, everyone and his or her mother makes in this field when they discuss it, which is an invocation of the principle of equivalence, which I just think is entirely beside the point if you think about it for 5 seconds. Then I'll introduce some machinery that I'll need in order to formulate and prove the result. That's the geometric fiber bundles and concomitance part. And in 5, I'll state the result and just give the briefest of sketches of how the proof goes. So we'll begin with a quote from Eddington, who, as I mentioned, is actually one of the few heroes in this whole debate. As soon as the principle of the conservation of energy was grasped, the physicist practically made it his definition of energy, so that energy was that something which obeyed the law of conservation. He followed the practice of the pure mathematician, defining energy by the properties he wished it to have, instead of describing how he measured it. This procedure has turned out to be rather unlucky in the light of the new developments. where the new developments are precisely the development of general relativity. So it's from his book, The Mathematical Theory of Relativity, and it
appeared in the very first edition, which I believe is 1921.
I was going to say 22, but something.
Okay. So,
and as I like this quote because I think that he really puts his finger on exactly what people who invoke the principle of equivalence are doing. Why this argument has been so tempting for so many people, because the argument turns on, as we'll see, on a principle, on a characteristic that it's a kind of knee-jerk reaction physicists think an energetic quantity should have or must have, but which turns out to be completely inappropriate in this context. But from a purely formal point of view, it seems to be just naively something you would expect. But when you actually think about the physics of general relativity, you see that it's not an appropriate condition. So a stress. How do you represent stress energetic quantities in general relativity? Well, with a stress energy tensor. I'll go through what I think are the main properties of a stress energy tensor that its mathematical properties and its physical interpretation that makes it the appropriate representation in GR for stress energy. So the fact that it has 10 components encodes the fact that, roughly speaking, there are 6 degrees of freedom for the classical stress tensor, 3 for linear momentum, and 1 for scalar energy density. That it has 2 covariant indices is, I claim, appropriate because the stress energy tensor, in its physical, what it physically represents, is a way to associate with an observer a four-momentum covector, the flux of momentum, and also a scalar density, the energy density that the observer will experience. So it defines a linear mapping from tangent vectors of world lines to covectors, and a bilinear mapping from tangent vectors to energy density, which encodes the fact that, very roughly speaking, momental phenomena are linear in velocity and energetic phenomena are quadratic in velocity. The fact that it's symmetric infinitesimally yields something like the classical conservation of angular momentum in the very, very small. And it also encodes part of the relativistic equivalence of momentum flux and energy density. To continue, the fact that it's covariantly divergence free, again, infinitesimally yields classical energy and linear momentum conservation. And also, it encodes the other part of the relativistic equivalence of momentum flux and energy density. The fact that it's a tensor represents the fact that it's localized and it's invariant. It's a true physical quantity with real physical content, with real intrinsic physical significance. And the fact that it's localized in this case is encoded in the fact that it's a multilinear map acting only on the tangent plane. That's more or less what one means by localized. That's what one wants. And the most complex property it has, or the one that is will almost certainly raise the most questions, I imagine, from people, and I think the hardest one in some sense to formulate precisely and think about, but also is formed the absolute one of the most crucial parts of the proof. So I am both expect and I'm happy to have people push me on this one. Is the idea that what makes this so far we've gone through more or less. We've gone through mathematical properties of the object and discussed their physical interpretation. We're now going to, this last one is something that does not straightforwardly have anything to do with the mathematical property of the object, although we'll see later on that it actually does. But it's really just a purely physical fact about it, that a stress energy tensor should have, in some sense, the physical dimension of stress energy. It should in some way or other encode the units, the physical dimension of stress energy. And that represents the thermodynamic, what I call the thermodynamic fungibility of energetic phenomena. I mean, if energy is exchangeable, energy is fungible, any form of energy, according to the first law of thermodynamics, should be transformable in principle into any other form of energy. And what that means is that you should always be able to add 2 stress energy tensors together and have that make physical sense. They form a vector space, not only formally, but physically. The addition of two stress energy tensors represents, we like to think, an in principle possible real physical interaction. And what makes that addition meaningful is the fact that they, in some sense, have the same physical dimension, the same units. Yes.
I
use the word ponderable to describe what we normally think of as stress energy, just as a way to distinguish it from a putative gravitational stress energy tensor. So ponderable stress energy is just any stress energy that is associated with what we think of as ordinary matter fields, ordinary radiation fields that are not directly gravitational in character.
So it's not a claim about that ordinary, say, energy density. Is it something that's straightforward to measure?
No, not the straightforward to measure, just that it's non-gravitational.
Okay.
Yeah. And so everything I'm saying here is about what I call ponderable stress energy, because presumably if there's going to be a gravitational stress energy tensor, it should have the same properties as non-gravitational forms of stress energy. So let's talk about this thermodynamical fungibility. As I say, I think the first law demands this idea that all forms of energy are in principle exchangeable. And the reason I like this form of the first law for GR, even though it's a non-standard formulation, and I'm not even sure what one would want to call a formulation of the first law. It's perhaps a necessary condition for a formulation of the first law. But I mean, because really there is no first law in general relativity. You can't integrate up energy in general over finite volumes. Usually doesn't even make sense to talk about the energy of space-time as a whole. So it's just not clear to me how one can even formulate a first law globally in general relativity. So I like this because you can formulate this, and it gives me, at least for my purposes, what I need. So what do I mean by physical dimension? All physical units in relativity can be expressed as a constant multiple of a single fundamental unit, so-called geometrized units. So let's say that you define time as, you define the fundamental interval of time as the temporal interval it takes for a photon to cross the diameter of a proton. You then define the fundamental unit of spatial length as the distance light travels in one fundamental unit of time. And you can define the unit of mass, although this one's actually really tricky, but I've never actually seen it done rigorously. It would be a very interesting, I think, project to do. You would define a unit of mass as that amount of mass such that when you have two of them, one spatial unit distance apart, tend to accelerate towards each other one spatial unit per unit of time per unit of time. And
the reason I say that's obviously a more complicated one than time or space one, just saying it. But the reason I say that it's not as rigorous as the other two is because in order to actually make it rigorous, you'd have to actually show that there was a real space-time model in which that happened. And as far as I know, no one's ever done that. So geometrized units are a funny thing. You just sort of take it on faith that they're well-defined, and I'm going to do that for the purposes of this talk. At least I'm not doing anything worse than anyone else does, which is small comfort.
We often take
refuge in that, don't we? So the way that one of the nice things about geometrizing the units in this way, say by setting C equals to 1, is that when you multiply the metric by a constant, which should have no physical consequences, it should just be a rescaling of units, all the fundamental units turn out all of time, space, and mass rescale in the same way. And it follows that a necessary condition for a quantity to have a given physical dimension is that it transforms under constant rescaling of the metric in a particular way. So if you multiply the metric by, say, by lambda, then in the units of time will transform by lambda to the minus 1/2, so will space and so will mass. Velocity won't rescale at all, because you just get the lambda minus 1/2 over lambda minus 1/2, they cancel out. So it's and in particular, it's easy to see from the Einstein field equation that stress energy tensors, when you rescale the metric, they should not change. The quantity of stress energy, the unit of stress energy shouldn't change. And you can see that because a simple calculation shows that rescaling the metric doesn't change the form of the Riemann tensor, as it shouldn't, because the Riemann tensor is physical. 6 times the Riemann tensor is not the same space-time as, you know, the Riemann tensor. So when you multiply, when you hit the metric with a constant, you shouldn't, the Riemann tensor remains unchanged. It then turns out that, you know, a simple calculation shows that the Einstein tensor then remains unchanged. The Newtonian gravitational constant is dimensionless. So Einstein's, you know, Einstein equation where this is the Newtonian gravitational constant. So this doesn't rescale, that doesn't rescale, so PAB shouldn't rescale. So stress energy should the unit of stress energy should remain constant. So it's a necessary condition for a tensor to represent stress energy, I claim, that it not rescale when the metric is multiplied by a constant. So now the question is, we now know what stress energy is in GR, how it's represented. Can one find such a thing that localizes and represents something like gravitational stress energy? So, I'll now quickly go through what I think is the universally given, but I think bad argument that shows why one can't do such a thing before moving on to what I hope and claim is a better argument. So a quote from Choquet Bruja, who is, I don't mean to beat up on her, she's an amazing, you know, great, great physicist. It's just that this quote happens just to incredibly nicely summarize the heart of the argument, the heart of what I claim is a bad argument. So this non-local character of gravitational energy is in fact obvious from a formulation of the equivalence principle, which says that the gravitational field appears as non-existent to one observer in free fall. It is mathematically a consequence of the fact that the pseudo-Riemannian connection, which represents the gravitational field, can always be made to vanish along a given curve by a change of coordinates. So the idea is, well, you know, if there were a gravitational field intensity as represented by the affine connection, can always be transformed away along a curve. So an observer, you know, traversing that curve could always be made to see, you know, zero gravitational energy if it's going to be expressed by those quantities, you know, as a combination of those quantities. So there can't be such an invariant thing. Now to draw out all of the most important part of the argument explicitly, what Choquet Bruja is relying on and what everyone else in the field relies on is this analogy with ponderable stress energy tensors, and in fact all known field energies for every known matter field is in fact quadratic in the field intensities. Based on the Newtonian analogy, the metric represents the gravitational field potential, so the coefficients of the affine structure represent something like the field intensity. So you would in fact expect, based on this analogy with every other stress energy tensor, that if there were such a gravitational thing, it would be quadratic in terms that represent the affine connection, and therefore it could not be an invariant quantity, at least, you know, along any given curve. And it's interesting to note that in fact all the pseudo tensors you ever come across are supposed to represent gravitational energy: the Einstein pseudo tensor, the Landau-Lipschitz pseudo tensor, just, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. All of them are in fact quadratic in affine terms. which is one of the reasons why they're not in varying quantities. Hyclimbus is totally irrelevant.
Are we talking about energy
and stress? No. This is stress energy moment. Stress energy
moment. Stress energy. So energy is just short for that.
Yeah.
Okay. And those are all quadratic. The momentum.
Yep. Thank you, the Maxwell field. They're all quadratic in the old
intake. Okay.
Yeah. B squared plus B squared. Even in Newtonian gravity,
in those special cases where one can in fact define a gravitational energy in Newtonian gravity, it's the energy is quadratic in the field, and the field intensity is quadratic in derivative of phi, derivative of the potential. I claim this is irrelevant though. If there is a gravitational energy, it must depend on the curvature. Precisely because not only is that the only invariant quantity around, but presumably, I mean, the most brain-dead obvious way of extracting energy from a gravitational field, pretty much the only way, as far as I can tell, is by geodesic deviation. You have to have things, gravity moving things apart or moving things together. And non-trivial geodesic deviation is precisely equivalent to non-zero Riemann tensor. The only space-time we expect there to be zero gravitational stress energy is one locally isometric to Minkowski spacetime, which is exactly one where Riemann tensor equals zero. So the fact that the fact that all other fields have stress energy that are based on terms quadratic and field intensity is completely irrelevant here. I mean, Paoli makes this point really nicely in his 1921 article, where he says. He discusses the issue, and he says, look, there is no physical reason whatsoever, no physical argument I know of or can think of, that would mandate gravitational energy behaving in this purely formal way as other the energies of other fields. And he's right. I've never seen a physical argument for it. I've just this hand-waving, you know, Newtonian analogy. But the Newtonian analogy is pretty weak and pretty bad for a lot of purposes. And it's just hand-waving. So the idea then is, I claim, that if there is to be such a thing, it should, as I say, it should be based on the Riemann tensor. It should involve terms that involve the Riemann tensor. And so what we want is to try and formulate a condition that shows that there can be no such tensor with all the proper properties that is based on the Riemann tensor. And in order to do that, we first have to define, characterize what it means for a tensor to depend in an appropriate way on another tensor. That's not manifestly obvious. It doesn't really make sense to talk about one tensor being straightforwardly a function of another tensor. Because you want that functional relationship to in some way capture something invariant in a physical significance. And your average function isn't going to respect that. You just have some mapping tensors to tensors. And you hit your manifold with a diffeomorphism, the relationship between them will probably get all screwed up and will no longer represent what the dependence is supposed to physically represent. So the idea is, and we want this functional dependence, this somehow generalized functional dependence of one tensor on another, because that's precisely supposed to capture the idea that if there is such a thing as a stress energy, it depends generically and structurally on at least the Riemann tensor. And that's what the idea of a concomitant is supposed to capture. We want a generic expression valid in any space-time that is supposed to represent this functional dependence. Just like in Newtonian particle mechanics, no matter what the exact system is, kinetic energy is always, one-half mv squared. And that holds for every single physical system. We want the same kind of functional relationship that will hold for every single space-time, irrespective of the idiosyncrasies of individual space-times. So we want a way to express this functional dependence of this hypothetical tensor on the Riemann tensor, called a concomitant of the Riemann tensor. And among other things, we want it to be zero when the Riemann tensor is zero. These are minimum conditions we want. So the first goal is to characterize concomitants. To do this, I'm first going to present, I'll do it in the language of fiber bundles. It just turns out to be incredibly convenient to do that. My presentation of the fiber bundles is a little idiosyncratic, but it turns out to be just the thing you need for this idea. So it's not really deep or anything. It's just a slightly different way of going about it, but I'll very quickly sketch it. So to begin with, I should say actually. Oh, I think I left out a slide. I did. So I'll say that for my purposes, a fiber bundle is. I don't know why. I want to write over there, even though I can't have the people over here. But so a fiber. Normally, you define a fiber bundle as a bundle space, a base space, a surjective mapping from the base from the bundle space, the base space, the projection, and. Some kind of group action on the fibers, on the pullback of space, of the manifold points by the projection. And this is and the group action is does many, many things. One thing that it encodes that is never made explicit, unless actually I guess you go back and read the classic treatments by Steenrod and Arisman. But in modern treatments it's never made explicit. One thing the group action encodes is the way that the action of a diffeomorphism on the base space gets lifted to the bundle space. It's not prima facie obvious otherwise how you're supposed to relate diffeos on the base space to diffeos on the bundle space. So it turns out, for my purposes, to be convenient to define fiber bundles a little more generally, not specifying the group action to start with. Just bundle space, base space, projection. And then, so for instance, if you have, in this case, you then are going to define what will complete, in the traditional sense, what will complete the definition of the bundle, is by defining a way of associating diffeos on the base space with diffeos on the bundle. And you can actually then use that mapping from diffeos to diffeos to actually reconstruct the group action. It's a different way of thinking about the way that objects in the bundle relate geometrically to objects in the base space. So you think of them as geometrical objects based directly on their on transformational properties that arise from transformations on the base space. The transformational geometry of the bundle arises directly in this way from the transformational properties of the base space. And secondarily, the group structure falls out. So for instance, an example of this kind of idea might be, this bundle might be the bundle whose fibers are one-dimensional vector spaces. And if I just tell you that with this structure, I haven't yet told you, for instance, whether the bundle is really the bundle of real scalars or really the bundle of n-forms, where n is the dimension of the underlying manifold. And in fact, it's neither one until you specify how diffeos on the base space get lifted to diffeos on the bundle space. And it's that different specification that will actually then define whether you're talking about scalars or n forms. So in order to define this the way that diffeos on base space get lifted to diffeos on bundle space, it's pretty obvious and straightforward, like what you're going to do. You say that basically a diffeomorphism is on the base space is consistent with one on the one on the bundle space is consistent with one on the base space, if it respects the action fiber wise. So, Doreen, how long, you said I should have to speak between about 50 minutes and an hour? Is that what you said? At 10 after? Okay, so I have like 20, 25 minutes left, half an hour, somewhere between 20. It's not that hard. So, So if you have a diffeo takes this point to that point on the base space, then this diffeo on the bundle space will be consistent with it if and only if it takes this fiber to that fiber. Simple enough. Mm-hmm. No, I want to make the global claim. And we'll say strongly consistent if whenever phi is the identity, whenever the diffeo on the base space is the identity in some open set, then it's also the identity on the lift of that open set. So we're now going to define the way that we lift these diffeos from the base space to the bundle space, quite generally called an induction, for lack of a better word. So if you have the groups of the diffeos on the base space and the bundle space respectively, then you define a subgroup. It turns out that it's very trivial to show that the diffeos that are strongly consistent on the bundle space form a subgroup of that. And so the obvious thing to do is to define an induction as an injective homomorphism from diffeos on the base space to diffeos on the bundle space. Now you actually can do a lot more with this, and it actually is very, very pretty differential topology. And you can put a lot more conditions on an induction that you actually have to put more conditions on it if you want to recover the full group structure of the fiber bundle based on the induction, but we don't need that for our purposes, so I'll leave that aside. And so finally, a geometric fiber bundle, I say, is one that is base space, bundle space, and induction. Tensor bundles are examples of a geometric fiber bundle. They have a natural induction, the one that's just defined by the ordinary pullback. Spinor bundles of spinorial objects are not. There's no known way to define a natural action of a diffeo on the base space to one on a spinor bundle, to one on a spinorial bundle. So finally, we can now use this machinery to define concomitants. And to do that, I first will just very quickly review the idea of a jet bundle. And speaking very, very just crudely and loosely, all we need for our purposes, a jet bundle is, if you have a fiber bundle, then the first jet bundle is a bundle over the same base space. And is such that in a way that you can make precise, the points of the jet bundle represent in a way kind of invariant derivatives of objects on the original bundle. But it's a more generalized idea of derivative than an affine connection, because it, for instance, allows you to talk about generalized derivatives of stuff like affine connections themselves. And a good way of thinking about a jet bundle is that the points of the jet bundle represent the leading terms in a Taylor polynomial expansion of whatever object the bundle is. And that turns out to be a nice invariant notion. And just the thing you want to talk about, kind of generalized changes of value as you move along the original bundle. And it turns out that in a very natural way, if B is a geometrical fiber bundle, if there is an induction from then that induction on the original bundle space induces an induction to one on to one on the jet space, and you can iterate taking jet bundles so that the nth jet bundle is obviously something like the nth generalized derivative of the objects that are in the original fiber in the original bundle space. There's an actual projection from higher order bundle spaces to lower order. You just drop all the higher order terms in the Taylor expansion. And this finally allows us to define what a concomitant is. So if we have two geometrical fiber bundles with their different inductions, then a zeroth order concomitant is a smooth mapping between them that, in effect, respects the action of the inductions. So,
right.
Now, what's the jet tunnel induction? You're sort of repeating that procedure
where you
have the diffeomorphisms on the bundle?
Right, so you have
the role of the diffeomorphisms on the base space.
Right, so you have the feature that here. Again, this induction is such that it's naturally based on the original induction, and it's such that if you give me a diffeo on the base space, it will naturally.
The jet bundle has the same base space as the original bundle.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And it will naturally induce a diffeo. On the jet space, and if you think about like tensor bundles, you can just sort of see how it happens. If you know how to pull tensors back, then you know how to pull back their Taylor polynomial expansions. And you can generalize that very easily. So, a concomitant is probably easiest to draw. Mapping from here to here. It's supposed to represent functional dependence of these objects, let's say Riemann tensors, to these objects, let's say it's two index tensors, candidate stress energy tensors. And the way it's supposed to work is if you have a diffeo on the base space, and you have the lifted diffeo here, that is lifted through the induction, well, I'm a little spaced out for antihistamines, I'm sorry, so it's probably taking me a little longer to draw stuff than I think I normally would. Although I'm pretty spaced out the best of times anyway. So the idea is that you want the proper functional dependence is, again, you want to capture the notion of invariance, intrinsic physical significance. It's got to be one that respects respects the diffeomorphism action, because the diffeomorphism group is the fundamental group, is the fundamental action that encodes invariance and physical significance in GR. So quite trivially, you want to be the case that, I think now pretty clear what you want. If chi maps this guy to that guy, and the lift of that guy gets mapped. I mean, if that guy gets mapped to that guy by the lift of the diffeo, then you want it to commute. If this guy gets mapped to that guy by the lift of the diffeo over here, you want to be the case that that maps to this. So it should be the case that if you first act on this point with incompetent and then hit it with the diffeo, you get the exact same thing as if you hit it with a diffeo and then act on it with concomitant. But they respect the diffeomorphism invariance. And now you can define higher order concomitants by defining smooth mappings from jet bundles to bundles. So this is the idea. This generalizes the idea of a functional dependence that depends not only on the object itself but on its derivatives. And there's some technical conditions that you have to. That we don't have to go into. And since everyone's eyes are glazing over as it is, I think I'll quickly move on.
Because of this
my eyes are glazing over, my God.
So why the jet bundle? Why not just another tensor bundle?
Because we want a way to try to represent the idea that this object over here depends not only on the value of this object, but on the way the value of this object is changing locally on something like a localized derivative. And I claim that jut bundles are, if not the, one of the most natural ways to represent this idea of a generalized derivative. Because we want to be able to represent the idea of a local rate
of change.
So you
don't want just you don't just want a one-on-one mapping, you want to be able to say how it varies is
right.
Mapped appropriately. And
exactly. And you'll see why in a moment, because you'll see why in a moment. So the first result of interest is that it doesn't actually have to do with concomitants, it has to do with jut bundles. And it has to, in particular, it has to do with the jut bundle metrics. And it turns out, quite surprisingly to me, that if you consider BG as the bundle of Lorentz metrics over an arbitrary manifold, it doesn't have to be four dimensions, just any old manifold. And you look at the first jut bundle, it's canonically diffeomorphic. There's a naturally distinguished diffeomorphism between that jut bundle and the bundle whose fibers consist of ordered pairs of the metric at that point and its associated affine connection. And the second jut bundle is naturally isomorphic, diffeomorphic, to the one whose fibers consist of the triples, which are these two guys and the associated Riemann tensor. So it immediately follows a very simple computation that any concomitant of the Riemann tensor must be a second-order concomitant of the metric. That's exactly why I want the jut bundles, because it turns out that because there's this natural association between jut bundles and these really nice physical bundles, I claim that this is one piece of evidence that jut bundles are the appropriate tool to use in this kind of analysis. So we can now finally sketch the proof. And to do that, of course, I'll first lay out the conditions. So we're now finally in a position to see what I claim are all the natural conditions such an object should satisfy if there were such a thing. And I'll just quickly go through the dilemmas you need that lead to the result. So I need to introduce one more term, I'm sorry to say. I say that a concomitant is homogeneous of weight W if, for any constant scalar field sigma, if you multiply the object by sigma and hit it with a concomitant, you get sigma raised to the power of W times the object. And the reason we want that is, again, because we're considering the way that I defined the physical dimension was by how objects transform under constant rescaling to the metric. So if we're going to consider concomitants of the metric, and we want to be able to characterize what we mean by having the physical dimension of stress energy, we need to be able to characterize how it is that concomitants transform when you hit them by constants. So the first lemma we need is that for n greater than or equal to 2, and it's just any old tensor, SAB, a 2-index tensor, doesn't have to be symmetric, doesn't have to be covariant divergence-free, just any old 2-index tensor that happens to be an nth-order homogeneous concomitant of GAB, which is, one of the conditions we want for a stress energy tensor. Well, we want n to equal 2, recall, because that's the concomitant from the bundle of Riemann tensors. Then rescaling the metric by the constant real number lambda multiplies SAB by lambda to the n minus 2. That's kind of a surprising result, that the way that SAB is transformed by rescaling the metric depends only on the order, only on what order of concomitant it is. And it also, in this case, the n equals 2 also depends quite sensitively on the fact that it's a two-index tensor. You just show this by simple combinatorial argument. And so in particular, SAB does not rescale, which recalls what we want for stress energy tensors, if and only if it's a second order concomitant. So SAB will have a necessary condition for SAB to have the physical dimension of stress energy is it not rescale.
that implies that it's a second-order concomitant of the metric, and recall that all second-order concomitants of the metric are concomitants of the Riemann tensor. So, the last and one of the trickiest issues that before I state before I just give the canonical list of necessary conditions this object must satisfy is whether we want to demand that such a thing have a vanishing covariant derivative. Now, straightforwardly, you would think you would want that because, you know, stress energy tensors have vanishing covariant derivative. But then you start running into really tricky problems because if gravitational energy is really going to be truly fungible, really transformable into any other form of stress energy, and it's going to have all the properties of stress energy, then presumably one of the things we're going to want is to stick this SAB on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And in fact, Einstein himself, in almost all the early derivations of the field equation, does argue that gravitational energy, although he uses the pseudotensor, should be stuck on the right-hand side of the Einstein field equation. So if there is such a thing as its SAB, then we should have something like this. Well, arguably at least. If you have something like this, though, presumably this represents the interaction between gravitation and, you know, between curvature and or ponderable matter. So so what you then want is this sum to be covariantly divergence-free, since the Einstein tensor is trivially covariantly divergence-free. But so in general, if you want to have a non-trivial interaction, that means that neither one of these guys is going to be covariantly divergence-free. That's what you mean by an interaction. So in order to avoid deep and highly speculative waters about the way that such a thing might enter into the right-hand side of the Einstein field equation, actually just bracket the whole fucking issue because it's just too hard. And I can get away with a much, much simpler necessary condition. So the condition that I want to demand is that it have vanishing covariant divergence only when TAB equals zero. I mean, not only when, but at least when TAB equals zero. That's all I need. And by demanding that much weaker condition, I can completely ignore all of these issues. So we can finally state the necessary condition I claim, natural necessary condition for such a thing, if there is such a thing, as a gravitational stress energy tensor. I claim it must be two covariant index, symmetric, second order, zero weight, homogeneous concomitant of the metric, that is not zero when the Riemann tensor is not zero, and it has vanishing covariant divergence when the stress energy tensor of ponderable matter vanishes. That, I claim, captures all relevant physical conditions. That was sick. So using the lemmas and there's one final theorem that again is of interest in its own right. So recall this lemma. We'll need this. We'll need this theorem, which, again, is, I think, of real interest in its own right. It turns out that every second order and higher symmetric divergence-free concomitant of the metric of two covariant index form is, in fact, the variation with respect to the metric of some scalar curvature invariant. There are 14 dimensions of scalar curvature invariants. So in scalar curvature invariants, you can construct the Riemann tensor, 14 functionally independent ones. If you consider the variation you pick some, you know, some class of 14 linearly independent ones, consider that their variation with respect to the metric, that forms a vector space. Turns out that vector space is naturally isomorphic to all second order and higher symmetric divergence tree concomitants of the metric. So this gives you a really, really nice way. So considering these variations gives you a really nice way to characterize all concomitants. You can also show of the metric. It's easy to show that in fact the order of the concomitant you get is directly related to the order of the scalar curvature invariant. The only way you're going to get a second order concomitant by varying the scalar curvature invariant is if the scalar curvature invariant is linear in the Riemann tensor. There's only one of those. That's the Gauss scalar, the Gauss curvature. So the only possible candidate we are left with is, in essence, the Einstein tensor itself, which is the variation of the Gauss scalar curvature. So the final theorem is the only two covariant index symmetric divergence-free second-order zero-weight homogeneous concomitants of the metric are constant multiples of the Einstein tensor. And as a corollary, there are none that don't vanish when the Riemann tensor doesn't vanish, or doesn't vanish X. That corollary by itself already shows why the Einstein tensor is not an appropriate thing to represent gravitational stress energy, because it can be zero when the Riemann tensor isn't zero, when, for instance, there's conformal curvature, but no ponderable matter. But in gravitational wave, in certain otherwise empty gravitational wave space-times, where presumably, you know, these gravitational wave space-times can have something like gravitational energy, if there is such a thing. We can use these gravitational waves to, you know, bend little pieces of piezoelectric and heat up cups of coffee. Although, as an interesting historical aside, Levi-Civita in 1918 actually proposed the Einstein tensor and I think Oscar Klein did as well, actually proposed the Einstein tensor to be, proposed that the Einstein tensor should be thought of as the gravitational stress energy tensor. And Einstein actually did not respond in the way that I just responded in rejecting it. He actually had a different argument against that proposal, which was it would make the total energy of any closed system identically zero. Because if GAB is all gravitational energy, and 8 pi TAB is all ponderable energy, and they're exactly equal, they cancel each other out. Which...
When they look at what's the constraint? The Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity.
Exactly.
H equals zero, so that means the total energy is zero.
Exactly.
It's kind of not the right way to think about it, but... Yeah.
So, that's the claim. That's the result. Thank you.
Do you want to get your own question?
Sure.
I just want to pick up on what you just said, because this is the intuitively, well, you said a lot of things, but you said something about the gravitational wave interacting and heating up a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. So you do, that'll happen. And in fact, as you know, I mean, the binary pulsar observations, so the very few, very little observational evidence there is for general relativity.
I only know the 5 tests, and binary pulsar is one of them.
Right, and you know, that you have this gravitating system, and it seems to be emitting gravitational waves. Why? Because it seems to be, you know, is it slowing down?
It's slowing down.
It's changing. So, yeah, you describe it as losing energy, and that would be gravitational energy, because it's not electromagnetic.
Right.
So, how would you think about it if you wanted to, you know, if not in terms of gravitational stress energy?
Yeah, well, what I think that results like this show are that general relativity is telling us that we need to change our conception of energy and stress energy in particular. That energy is not always localizable. And I claim that this shouldn't actually be very surprising, because when you start thinking about all the different ways energy appears even in classical physics, there are plenty of cases where energy really isn't localizable even in classical physics. when thermal energy in a hot gas isn't a continuous energy density for that.
Why not?
Well, because it's discrete molecules,
but no individual
molecule can be. You can't attribute a thermal energy to any individual molecule. It's a physical average. So, and in Newtonian gravitational theory, again, generically, you cannot define a physically significant energy density for the Newtonian gravitational field, although you can in certain very, very particular cases. What this is telling us is that energy, and stress energy in particular, has a much less fundamental status, or at least a very different status in general relativity than how we're used to thinking about it. In, for instance, both classical mechanics and in quantum theory. We don't have anything like the conservation laws here that we have in, say, quantum theory. And this is part of the reason, because we can't localize this stuff. Conservation laws are generally based on quantities that can be localized, that you can track, creation of, destruction of, and flow of. You specifically can't do that here because you can't localize the quantity. So it seems to me that the most useful concept of, so one way of thinking about this result is that there are several different ways of thinking about of energetic quantities in general relativity that in classical mechanics and quantum mechanics all converge and give the same result, but actually fall apart and give different results or just nonsensical results in GR. So there's a
Could you elaborate,
one example? Yeah, sure. So for gravitational radiation, you can define the amount of work a gravitational wave contains by the amount of work it can do. But you can't represent it by a localized energy density. For a Maxwell field, especially a highly symmetrical Maxwell field, you can define such a thing as what looks very much like and plays the same role as a scalar density, a scalar energetic density. But in general, you're not going to be able to define a conservation law which allows you to define the idea of doing work on charged particles. You will be able to in certain very specialized space times. But not in general. So in classical physics, the idea of doing work and these conserved scalar fields always went together and gave the same results. That's what we mean by conservation law. But in GR, they fall apart. So the situation is somewhat analogous, I think, to there are those papers by David Malamud on different ways of thinking about rotation in general relativity and how they all these ways of thinking about rotation give the same result in classical physics, but give different results in general relativity. I tend to think it's not exactly analogous, but it's somewhat analogous. A somewhat analogous situation here.
I was going to ask essentially about how analogous it is, because I mean here the so there's several things that are similar. One is that there are cases in GR where you can recover a tighter connection if you introduce a lot of symmetries, right. either globally or as an asymptotic supersymmetry. So there's a way in which you could see the claim as the various aspects of energy that we're familiar with come apart in general relativity. You can only recover it in some special cases, mm-hmm. where you introduce, say, asymptotic infinity, then you can talk about the positive mass theorems and those sorts of things.
Right.
Because you've sort of restricted yourself to a subset of general relativistic solutions and used mm-hmm. that extra structure. The other thing, I think I'm in agreement with your line that the there's no flaw of general relativity that's revealed by this. It's rather that our intuitions about energy have to be readjusted, but a lot of the arguments that go from the, you know, the bad arguments that you don't like from the principle of equivalence line, end up in roughly that same conclusion, right? So you end up saying something like, well, energy, so, you know, like Weinberg, for example, in the 72 book says, well, energy, we don't have a locally defined quantity, but, well, any sort of hand waves towards asymptotic treatments, they weren't sort of rigorous at that point, but... but so the conclusion is similar to...
It is.
Okay.
And like I was saying, all the formal work here is in the service of just making precise and proving rigorously what has been folklore mythology in the field.
Right.
And hoping that will give us a way to clarify and make precise these claims about ways that one can and can't think about energy.
Mm-hmm.
So with this kind of result, for instance, I haven't actually done it, but I thought about doing it. You know, best intentions and all that, is one could actually, I think, give precise operational definitions of different ways of measuring energy and show that they give differing results in different situations, whereas they would give the same results in classical spacetimes. Problem?
Sorry, I missed the point about what exactly the bad arguments were. At least were they? I don't know if you were. Maybe you referred to old work by Ehlers, for example.
I actually referred to basically everyone and his or her mother in the history of GR,
okay.
Except for basically Pauli and Eddington. The argument is incredibly trivial and simple. I can recapitulate it in 45 seconds, I think. You invoke the principle of equivalence to say that. There, you can always transform away the affine connection along the component of the affine connection along the curve. If there's a gravitational stress energy, if there's a gravitational invariant energetic quantity, it should be quadratic in those affine components because those represent field intensities, and all other stress energy tensors we know of are quadratic in field intensities. Therefore, there can be no invariant energetic quantity. And I just think it's entirely beside the point, because if there is an energetic and gravitational quantity, it has to depend on the Riemann tensor. Because one way of extracting work is geodesic deviation. Non-trivial geodesic deviation arises and only arises when Riemann tensor is not equal to zero.
I'm just thinking of, more generally, of Ehlers' papers from a long time ago on the difficulty of assigning, of talking about something like the total energy of a gravitating system.
Right.
We're talking about what the nature of an isolated system in general and what a difficult concept that is.
Mm-hmm.
And one could think of this in a more general setting as, I'm not sure if I got the direction you were heading at the end in your very brief remarks. I mean, that... one could think of it from a more general philosophical perspective as one of those cases like the Malinin case in which really what we've sort of missed the point of what general relativity is telling us by focusing on the kind of philosophical issue we usually do about, you know, whether things are more relative than they used to be or are they still absolute and all that. But really, it's a question of how justified we are in the extension over space-time of reasoning that is locally valid. Right? How much we justify in extending over space-time a theory of measurement, for example, that works very well locally.
So I think you put your finger on one of the most important issues in this area, and the issue of isolability is I think directly related to this, because I think that this again makes precise one sense in which the idea of an isolated system just kind of falls apart in relativity, and again that shouldn't be so much of a surprise because.
What do you mean it falls apart? I mean,
well,
that's
what
the whole
What do you mean by isolated system? Because you can't shield gravity. Gravity is the only force that you can't build a shield for. So there's never a truly isolated system.
But an asymptotically flat model is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a model. You're ignoring the stuff. You're not. So
the models are artificial extensions
yeah.
by the imposition of, as you were saying, right, mm-hmm. the imposition of asymptotic mm-hmm. structure, right?
Right, so
of conditions that approximate those cases in the Newtonian case where you could have an isolated system or
right.
total energy of the system.
So that's what I mean when I say that the idea of complete isolability more or less falls apart in GR.
Well, I would have said it falls apart in our world. It doesn't fall apart. It's not probably the theory admits models that are like isolated systems, but your point seems to be that the world doesn't.
I'm happy to accept that amendment.
Okay. Sorry, I'm confused now about because the way you phrased the complete isolability falling apart just now seemed to be valid for Newtonian. You can't shield gravitational forces.
That's right. If I agree to that, then I did so incorrectly.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. So I say it shouldn't be so surprising.
But it's that Newtonian. I think what Steve is maybe thinking of is you know, this intuition you have. I can't think of the source of this, but I know I've heard people say this, and it seems obvious. Like, there's an intuition that one of the things that GR teaches us about the world is that in the Newtonian case, you have this notion of a gravitationally bound system, and you have this Newtonian idea that having summed all the gravitational actions in it, you're in a position to exclude any mass that isn't entering into one of this set of action-reaction pairs.
I see what you're saying.
It's the old Newtonian argument of Newton himself, right, against more ponderable matter being there in the solar system, like in the shape of vertical fluid.
Right, I see what you're saying.
So one of the things we think we learn about GR is, well, it is more like a dynamical field, and there's this idea of the system losing energy, and that's a really fundamental.
So is the idea something like the following in Newtonian gravity? Even though you can't shield gravity, the approximation of ignoring very, very far away bodies is actually well formed. We can formulate that precisely because you can individuate the components of the gravitational force that depend on individual masses. And that's precisely what you can't do in GR because the field equation is nonlinear. So you can't individuate and isolate components of what you want to think of as the field of point as being due to the far-away masses as opposed to the close masses. So that in fact is one way of thinking about why the approximation is better defined in Newtonian gravity than it is in GR. I really like that. Actually, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Are you aware of anything? Yeah. I was thinking of Meinheim's alternative to GR, motivated by wanting to get something more.
Right.
So you're attacking his motivation to start with, even, I take it.
Yeah, I'm saying that projects like that seem to me to be ignoring something fundamental. That if GR really is our best theory, they seem to be trying to explicitly ignore something important that GR is trying to tell us. And if I remember correctly, Mannheim's theory requires a flat space-time background, specifically. And so the symmetries of the flat space-time background that allow him to construct a lot of these quantities that one can't in general construct in GR. But that's just a highly artificial and very different theory than GR. And one in which these lessons don't hold. So if it is in fact a better theory than GR, then these putative philosophical lessons don't follow. But insofar as we think of GR as the best theory, then I think projects like Mannheim are fundamentally misguided.
And this is something. I mean, there was a while there where, because he was getting the flat rotation curves in spiral galaxies,
right?
When they looked really good for him. And of course, the lensing. Mm. Yeah. But is there
I'm sorry.
Is there, not that you should, but I was wondering if you could say anything about connections between this, your lesson, and what's wrong with the way he was getting the flat rotation curves.
I don't know the details of that calculation. Yeah. I only know the general formulation of the theory.
Yeah.
So, any fine details? I don't know.
So can I say just one other?
No, I'm sorry.
How do you think about it? This is just about, these are just sort of intuitive questions about why you might think you need some sort of characterization of gravitational stress energy. And the other thing that the pulsar example doesn't carry is you don't get any, that's all gravitation. You know, it's the gravitational potential energy of a binary system and then the gravitational waves. But it's all at the level of gravity. There's no intermixture of gravitational energy with like electromagnetic energy. Mm-hmm. But you can also presumably do that. And why doesn't that create problems? So I send in a gravitational wave and an accelerated charge, and the charge radiates. So now I have energy in the electromagnetic field that I didn't have before. Where did it come from? Why don't I have a problem with the conservation of the TAB, which is... do you have a sense of how that works? Is there something have you learned there?
I think it's a really complex issue. I mean, insofar as this is what we want to think of is something like gravitational energy manifestly does get transformed into other kinds of energy that have seemingly different formal properties. And so my sense is that our normal ways of thinking about the first law, in fact, don't apply in GR. So these different ways of, we do these quantities in some way or other, as far as we even talk about the quantities in this case, do seem to be somewhat interchangeable. Intertransformable, but not in any sense that we're used to classically. So the general idea of a conservation law really falls apart. I think one lesson of this is that the fact that TAB is covariantly divergence free really isn't a conservation law in any classical sense of the term.
So you start integrating it,
and in general you can.
Right.
So I actually think it's a mistake to think of NABLA TAB equals zero as a conservation law, and especially since it's more or less an identity imposed on you by the Einstein-Biot equation. Conservation laws should be something with physical content, not trivial identities of differential topology.
So can I ask a little further on this? So do you want to say that what we lack is an ability to say something like there was energy that was, taken away from the pulsar system and then transferred to our little gravitational interferometer or whatever that, we see as then producing an accelerating charge? And is it that you want to say you can't? I mean, obviously you can't say that because there's no global way of tracing energetic quantities because you can't integrate up the covariant divergence law, but it sounds to me like you want to say something more fundamental, that there's something more than that. I think that's, there's the sort of classical associations with the conservation laws that there's a conserved quantity that you can trace.
Right.
And given that you can't integrate up the covariant divergence law except in symmetric spacetimes, you can't have this conserved quantity that you can say is being transferred from the pulsar to the system. But
and even the symmetric space time, you can't trace a gravitational quantity.
So I agree with you there, but it sounded like you wanted to say something more than that. That there's something, the covariant divergence, that doesn't have any physical content. There's no sense in which there's conservation of energy in GR. Is that what you were claiming? A stronger?
I'm claiming that in anything like a classical sense, there's no energy. I don't know how to think about energy conservation in GR. There is, just because I know how to do a calculation from binaries with collapsing orbit and over here, curvature in between and little piezoelectric things moving around over here. Mm-hmm. I can do that calculation, and under certain approximations, I can write down stuff that looks kind of like classical energetic quantities. Mm-hmm. And in those approximations, I can show that they are approximately equal. You know, what goes down over here is, you know, what comes up over there, you know, quantitatively. But because these are fundamentally approximations and not even very physically well motivated ones, except for just the fact that they seem to work okay, which I guess is pretty physical motivation. It's not clear to me what given all these facts, what fundamental status one wants to give to covariant divergence free, the fact that Mm-hmm. Mr. tensors are covariantly divergence free, because in fact, the fact that they're covariantly divergence free doesn't play a big role in these calculations. You know, in these approximations, you don't trace the path flow of some conserved quantity along the way. You just do a bunch of calculations and integrate up these approximate quantities, and they turn out to be roughly equal. But the fact that the Shesterkin tensor is covariantly divergence free doesn't play a big role in that calculation.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we're still on the part where we kind of agree. The question is then, what do you say about the? I mean, so okay, so the covariant divergence. So in some sense, it follows directly from the properties of the Einstein tensor to say that Biot-Gyurin force you to have that covariant divergence vanish, and you might think that just then explains why you have the covariant divergence vanish over here. Mm-hmm. But there's still, I mean, there's still a claim there, right? There's still a claim about the stress energy tensor. It doesn't play the role of allowing you to define conserved quantities mm-hmm. over finite regions of space-time that you can see as tracing energy and momentum flow. I agree with you fully on that, but to say that there's no sense of energy conservation in GR, that there's nothing like...
Only as a very, very brute force and rather crude approximation, and that only under special circumstances.
No, I'm just saying that the covariant divergences, so the I'm not saying that what I want to save is something that is the thing that is associated with energy conservation over finite regions. Mm-hmm. Rather, there's still some sense of energy conservation.
In the very, very small local region.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
So,
there must be, because that's what it looks like, you know, on the surface of the Earth. That's why the principle of conservation of energy is so powerful. So, of course, just physically, there must be something that looks like it at the very, very small level and in areas of very, very low-intensity curvature. Mm-hmm. But it's only an approximation.
Yeah. Well, it's only, yeah, sorry.
No, but I just...
Well, as I say, I mean, it's only an approximation when you send it to the finite regions, but there's still something which corresponds to a conservation principle. The fact that it doesn't have some of the things we associate with the conservation principle in the classical case doesn't mean, so I'm arguing that doesn't mean that we should say it's not a conservation principle. It should mean that it's a conservation principle that might not have all the implications we thought it might, but that's just a reformulation of what we've now refined what we mean by conserved quantities. I mean, it's not just energy, it's saying the momentum, all these other...
I don't want to argue about words. You give me your list of exactly what conditions are satisfied, mm-hmm. and then, you know, and then if you want to call that, you know, conservation law, you know, more power to you. But my very strong sense is that list is going to look very different than the list you would compile.
Oh, no, that's... I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think we're at this point debating about some fairly minor point that we agree about. The change in the list is probably the important.
Stephen?
Well, this is just sort of to take your side of this argument, that if you're looking for one way to think about your insight is that we shouldn't really, since conservation laws have to do with conservation over time, and general relativity, there is no canonical way to divide space into space and time, so not even in a sort of, you know, set of reference frames, except when you have asymptotically flat systems, that you really shouldn't expect a notion. You would be almost in trouble if the notion of, if you had a really robust notion of conservation of energy momentum.
I fully agree. Yeah, it would, things would look really weird if you did precisely those.
No matter how, what kind of weird space-like surfaces I foliated in my space-time, but some quantity that was the integral over the whole surface was conserved.
Yeah, no matter what your space-time looked like. Yeah, that, I agree that that would be very, that would be very, very odd.
Right, and that's effectively what the demand here, the conditions you put on, were demanding, some quantity like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I was going to say something very similar to what Steve said. I mean, it's the difference between having this identity that follows from the form of the Einstein field equation and having the old-fashioned kind of conservation principle, where, I mean, it really is bound to symmetries that exist in space-time, right? And that's just not... Well, that's not merely a kind of, that's not an incidental difference at all, right?
Mm-hmm. No, there's even more to say about it than that. It's not just bound to symmetries. It's bound to the idea that we can define something called doing work. Because the classical conservation law, it wouldn't hold if we couldn't include work terms. But in general, the idea of doing work doesn't make sense at all in general relativity. It only makes sense for a few kinds of systems and then only as an approximation. And it loses all connection. Even in highly spectral space-times, it's very difficult to see a connection between the way of defining something like the way geodesic deviation can do work and the conserved quantities one defines by killing fields. There's just no connection whatsoever between them. And so, yeah, in that sense also, what one is going to get is not to look at all like a classical conservation law.
This is a more like a footnote, but I want to give a slightly positive thing for a localizable notion. Think of the gravitational self-energy of a planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, it's not really isolated, but there's something that you get in the stress energy tensor that's playing sort of the role. Never mind the overall conservation stuff, but the role of having it be part of a stress energy this thing, and that's
well.
You know,
I mean, so
those planets stay far enough away from each other.
But again, so in Newtonian gravity, the gravitational binding energy of the planet is a well-defined concept, but in GR, I claim it's not, precisely because the field equations are nonlinear. You're not going to be able to cleanly separate out components that are just due to the matter of the planet, as opposed to even if the matter of that is very, very, very far away, or even matter, even those curvature terms arising from conformal curvature.
You won't be able to do it exactly. But
no.
Getting...
But you can approximate it. I agree.
Yeah,
very well.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that the approximation is not well. It's not well founded the way the approximation is in Newtonian physics. In Newtonian physics, there is a precise clean, you know, set of rules for doing it, and GR is just see to the pants, what smells right.
That's probably a good place to stay there again, and go for it.